Welcome once again to Why Should We Care About the Indo-Pacific, brought to you by IEJ Media and our sponsor at Bauer Group Asia. We'll talk about more of them later. I'm Ray Powell, the former military officer. That's Jim Caruso, the former diplomat. Jim, how are you?
You always ask, but you don't really care.
No, I don't really, but you're supposed to say something like, this is small talk. This is banter.
Oh, banter. I'm very well, thank you, Raymond. How are you?
Good. Awesome. Awesome. Well, you're obviously boring when it comes to that. So we're going to talk to somebody who's exciting. And this is our friend, Dr. Salvatore Sal Mercogliano. He's a maritime historian, a former merchant mariner. We'll talk about that a little bit. An associate professor of history at Campbell University in North Carolina. He also runs the very popular YouTube channel, What's Going On With Shipping, which has over 400,000 subscribers, Jim.
Something I aim for.
We'll get there. All right. So, Sal, we're talking about dark fleets, and we want to kind of unpack, you know, from an Indo-Pacific perspective, what are dark fleets, and why should our Indo-Pacific audience care about them?
Well, first, thanks for having me on. I appreciate it. It's great to be with you guys. So dark fleet, you know, you'll hear it called the gray fleet, the shadow fleet. I like to call it the parallel fleet. So what happened back in after the invasion of Ukraine by Russia was a series of sanctions were initiated by the G7, the EU, and a few other countries against Russia. In particular, what they wanted to do was to penalize Russia for invading Ukraine, but at the same time, not disrupt the flow of petroleum out of Russia. So they wanted a little bit of both worlds. They wanted that sweet crude coming out of Russia, but they did not want to stop it coming out, but they wanted it not to be as profitable. So they initiated a price cap. Basically, what they said was that if you haul Russian crude oil, you couldn't do it if it was over $60 a barrel. If it's diesel, it's over $100 a barrel. And the mechanism they use is insurance. And insurance is the bedrock of commercial shipping. If you don't understand insurance, you're not understanding shipping. And so they got the 12 what are major P&I, what are called protection indemnity clubs. These are the big insurance companies for shipping. And they used them and they sat there and said, okay, you will not insure vessels over that price cap. And the idea was this would stop movement. If you didn't have insurance, you were not going to sail. Well, what the Russians did is looked at sanctions that were leveled against Venezuela and Iran and other countries that we've done sanctions in the past. And they looked at that and they basically took what those countries did and put it on steroids. So what they did is they reflagged the vessels to these new registries, registries that are really outside the bounds of normal ship registries. And more importantly, they moved the operating companies from Russia and other places to new shadow companies in places like the UAE, in Singapore and Hong Kong and other countries. And most importantly, they got new insurance companies. They created either new insurance companies or don't even have insurance at all. And so what we're seeing created right now are ships that are carrying Russian crude, Russian diesel, that are operating outside the mainstream of commercial shipping. And this is why I like to call it a parallel fleet. It's not that the ships are operating illegally. They're operating outside the bounds of what are normal shipping. So, for example, they're not pulling into ports that they would normally pull into. Under the IMO, the International Maritime Organization, countries have the right to inspect vessels to make sure they're meeting compliance. But that requires the ships to pull into ports where they can do that inspection. If they are, for example, sailing with Russian crude and then meeting a vessel off the coast of Malaysia and then doing a ship-to-ship transfer and loading that into one or many other vessels, that ship will never be inspected. And what we're seeing right now is kind of a rash of incidents involving Russian ships that could be sabotage or they could just be really poor Russian ship maintenance, which is what I tend to think what they are. And this is the problem. And the fear here is that we're creating this parallel fleet on the world's oceans and we're kind of bifurcating the commercial shipping in the world.
So what I don't get, Sal, is, as you said, there are minimum requirements for environmental rules and labor rules that all countries are supposed to abide by. And you said they have to pull in the port for the inspection. But, for instance, coast guards will stop vessels, certainly in the territorial waters, and even, I believe, sometimes in international waters that abound the exclusive economic zones. Is that a possibility of a way to sort of put this under control?
It is, and we're seeing that right now, for example, in the Baltic, where we've had a series of cable cuts, and you're hearing the Baltic states, and particularly countries like Denmark, Finland, Estonia, and Sweden, talking about that. The problem you have is Section 19 of UNCLOS, the UN Convention of the Law of the Sea, which basically guarantees innocent passage. In other words, you can't stop a ship that is merely sailing even through your waters if the ship is conducting an innocent passage. The problem is the onus is on you to prove it's not an innocent passage. This is what we do with Freedom of Navigation Acts. So, for example, when we see steam through the Taiwan Straits, we're arguing this is an innocent passage. We have the right to do this, even if it's within the EEZ of China or Taiwan or any country. And so you get into a very difficult situation where you got to be careful about boarding. A lot of the boardings that we've done in the past had either UN sanctions on them, or there were other some sort of mandate that was put into effect to do these sort of boardings. And what we're seeing right now in the Baltic is there's a big question about whether you can just board Russian ships for fear that they're dragging anchors or some sort of device to cut cables, and whether you have the justification to do that or not. And so what we're seeing is these ships operating outside the normal bounds. I mean, you've got ships that are registered in what was the former state of Swaziland, for example, and that state isn't even a part of the International Maritime Organization. One of the biggest ones right now that's growing is Mongolia, the big seafaring nation of Mongolia. So not a lot of shipping in Ulaanbaatar, but this is what we're seeing happen out on the high seas.
So, you're talking about innocent passage, and of course, bringing us back to the Indo-Pacific, what we're seeing off of Taiwan is cable cuts that seem to involve ships that are clearly, whatever they're doing, it's not innocent passage. These ships are not moving in a straight line. They're just meandering about, which, again, they can do if they're in international waters or even in an exclusive economic zone. They just can't do it in a territorial sea, right? And yet we've got all of these ships just wandering about. Do we have to worry that all these sort of meandering ships are dragging anchors and cutting cables?
Well, I mean, it is a concern. I mean, because what we're finding out is number one, it's really easy to break a cable. I mean, it doesn't take that much to do it. The vast majority of undersea cables are just lying on the ocean floor. They're marked on charts because we want them marked on charts so you don't drop an anchor on them. And so we know exactly where they are. And, one of the big things, and I talk about this quite a lot, is we really need the International Maritime Organization, which is the UN arm of shipping. It's supposed to be the overseeing agency for really shipping, is to come out with some more, I would argue, muscle to things like AIS reporting and ensuring that vessels cannot just operate without clear, identification, who they are, who their ownership is, all the details that you want in shipping. Because one of the things, as you mentioned, is what are these ships doing? We don't know. I mean, because there's really no real mechanism to have to report to what ships are doing. There's not a real mechanism to know who owns a ship, what insurance they have on the ship. This is, whenever somebody tells me, it's like, well, I know who owns a ship. I know who insures a ship. It's like, do you really? Because it is a mask, because one of the things that we've become very good at in shipping is masking ownership, so that if a accident happens, there are levels that you have to burrow through to get to whoever the owner is. And even when you get to that, there's not a lot of assets at the end of it. So it's very difficult to tell. So, ocean shipping is really very myopic. It's hard to get a clear picture. And, especially in the Indo-Pacific, where you have so many vessels that are operating and are not just scheduled sailing routes from point A to point B. They're picking up containers. You can find their vessel schedule on a shipping channel. There's just a lot of traffic out in that region. And especially when you start getting into fishing boats and maritime militias and all these other vessels, it's really hard to paint through the picture and really to figure out patterns because of the number of ships. We're talking about over 100,000 ships, over 1,000 gross tons on the world's ocean. It overwhelms literally everything.
I was posted in Cyprus for a few years, and I remember going into the shipping agent organization as well as the government saying, you guys got to clean up your registry because you're doing some bad things. That's when the United States was big and bad, not like now. Couldn't we do that to Mongolia or other flags of convenience? Say, you can't keep registering these basically pirate ships.
Well, I mean, you see that being done. So, for example, the UAE came out against ships that were flagged in Swaziland. It's not Swaziland. I forget the name of the nation now, but it's the former Swaziland. But it's, you know, they came out and did that. And, you know, one of the things that you do is under these memorandum of understandings that are formed with nations that do the port state inspections, they can black flag ships. They can sit there and say, we're not going to accept ships of these registries in. But again, the problem you have like with the shadow fleet is they don't come to port. They're not going to come into a port whereby you can inspect them and therefore find the deficiencies with them. Instead, they're going to operate outside the bounds. So, you know, I'm going to load Russian oil in Ust-Luga and I'm going to sail to India, and I'm not even going to go into India. I'm just going to anchor off India and then have smaller ships come in and distribute the fuel. The only place I'm coming in is Russia. Russia is not going to inspect me, and therefore I can just basically operate outside the bounds. And even then, you know, what we saw happen a few years ago off the coast of Malaysia is you had a ship like the Pablo, which was anchored off of Malaysia. The ship's inert gas system, this is the system that lowers oxygen level in the tank so you can prevent an explosion. That system went inoperative. They didn't fix it. And what they had was a catastrophic explosion that literally peeled the top of the tanker off the vessel, killed two crew members. And then you had the issue of who owned the ship, who's going to do the cleanup, and no one was taking, you know, ownership of that. And it wound up being Malaysia having to step in and do something to clean up the mess out there. And this is my point. The IMO under the UN, you know, the way IMO operates is every country has a vote. Well, it's great if you're the United States, but you're one of 193 nations then. You really need a lot more votes in there. And the U.S. has not been, in my opinion, very advocate and very, very strong in the IMO to get other nations in line with this to really make those changes.
So you brought up the IMO and you sort of implied that it came out of the structure of the UN Convention of the Law of the Sea. Can you tell us a little bit more about what is the International Maritime Organization? How did it come to be? Why is it? And what are its deficiencies?
So IMO actually comes out of the founding of the UN. And so when the U.S. got the United Nations headquartered in the United States, initially San Francisco, later New York, Great Britain wanted something. And so they took the IMO. They said, we want the shipping side, because at the time, Great Britain was one of the leaders in shipping at the time. And so the International Maritime Organization really sets the international conventions for levels of shipping. Basically, this is the international levels we should be at. So, you know, you can go all the way back to safety of life at sea, which was originated in 1912 with the Titanic. You can talk about the Marine Pollution Acts that came into effect in the 1960s and 70s with a series of really horrific tanker accidents. And so IMO helps to set the standards, really set goals for ocean shipping. Now, their focus today tends to be more on carbon emissions. So one of the things that they're trying to do is make the largest objects ever made by humans, you know, carbon neutral. Basically, they're not going to be emitting anything by 2050. And I have the solution to that. It's called a sailboat. The problem is you can't really move 20,000 containers on a sailboat. It's a big problem. And so the IMO becomes this agency that really sets the standard. Now, they were lagging for a long time. I would argue they jumped ahead here a while. And one of the things that we're seeing now is, thanks to things like port state control, the U.S. Coast Guard boards vessels coming into U.S. ports. So we get to have a Coast Guard team go on board and inspect. The problem with that is 80,000 ships a year come into the United States. Only about 10,000 are inspected because of just the sheer numbers. And even the inspections that are done, you have a very limited amount of time on board the ship. You have very young, inexperienced Coast Guard crews who don't really know commercial shipping. And so we don't catch everything. This is an issue we had with the dolly taking out the bridge in Baltimore, for example. And so, you know, around the world, this is supposed to be done. And so, you know, in the Far East, you operate under the Tokyo MOU. In Europe, it's the Paris MOU. It's the Riyadh in the Middle East. And countries are supposed to do these inspections, and they issue alerts out. Hey, ships from this registry are giving us problems. You get a flag, black, white, or gray, depending on your level of efficiency. And that will alert countries for, you know, more, you know, this ship needs more of an inspection because of the track record, or we're just not going to accept these ships anymore. The problem is, again, is what is the IMO's function? The IMO's function right now tends to be more toward environmental issues, ESG issues now. I would argue they've got to get back more to regulatory issues, dealing with the proliferation of these open registries. You know, back in the day, Panama, Liberia, Marshall Islands, biggest three ocean open registries there are, they're good registries right now. I don't care what anybody tells you, they are good registries. They have got mechanisms in place. They operate good ships. The problem are these new registries, St. Kitts, Cook Islands, Nevis, you know, all these little ones that keep popping up that are just PO boxes and paying the government some money and you can fly your flag. That's the problem. And now these insurance companies are the other big problem, because now you're not running with the 12 big international P&I clubs. Now you're setting up kind of mom and pop insurance companies, so that if an accident happens, who's going to be responsible for this? We had during COVID a tanker go aground in Mauritius. And, you know, there was a lot of debate about who's responsible for this cleanup. And there was a lot of chasing down who the owner of the ship was, who the insurance company was. This has been, you know, I would argue, magnified. And unfortunately, the IMO is very slow at legislating change.
So the Trump administration has vowed to crack down on Iranian oil exports, which are under sanction, and I presume are being transferred under from these gray fleets to India and China. Is there a way that he can fulfill this promise given the current situation?
Well, what we've seen done is, and we're seeing with the Russian fleet, is the United States and EU are issuing, I think the EU is up to its 16th level of sanctions against Russian tankers, and they're going out and individually identifying tankers at this point. So they're adding them to sanction lists. So, you know, the initial effort was just to do the price cap, but now ships that are seen to be violating those price caps are getting listed to, you know, the OFAC and other agencies' sanction list. And, you know, every ship has an IMO number. You can't change that. You can change your ship name 10, 20 times, but your IMO number is never supposed to change. So that once you get tagged with that sanction, then the question becomes the sanction follows the ship. So in the case of Russian oil, for example, there are some cases where Russian tankers have been targeted by the State Department. They show up in India, and India doesn't want to touch them now because they don't want to get touched with the sanction, because the sanction will cover, will attach to them too. And, you know, what's going to happen here is if the Trump administration expands, which we expect to happen with the Iranians, then we're going to see NTIC, the Iranian national tanker company, be saddled with the same thing. But the fear is that you start trading then outside the U.S. mechanism. You know, does BRICS create their own kind of trading system outside the mainstream of the U.S. developed nations? And I think that's a big issue, because then you're going back to almost like a system of mercantilism of the 17th, 18th century, where you have kind of closed economic systems. What's made ocean shipping great is it's open. It's been, you know, since 1945 and, you know, Bretton Woods and all this kind of great stuff. You have open seas. And literally since the end of World War II, we've had pretty much, you know, freedom of the seas and the ability to trade. You know, even during the height of the Cold War, the Russians were really behind a closed economic system. But since the fall of the Soviet Union, we're in this big, huge, massive open trade system. Now we're in danger of creating this secondary system. And that would create competition on the oceans for ships.
That almost seems kind of inevitable, honestly. As you talk about it, tell me about ship to ship transfers. Are they inherently bad? I mean, is a ship to ship transfer almost always a bad thing, and is it usually an illegal thing?
So ship to ship transfers, I would say, are not inherently bad. I mean, we see vessels transferring fuel all the time. I mean, go to the Gulf Coast of the United States, and you have ships going to the Loop, the Louisiana Offshore Petroleum System, and you'll see, you know, very similar ship-to-ship transfers going on there. The problem you have with the Russians in particularly is it's magnified. Number one, it's taking place in places that are not regulated. So, for example, the Gulf of Laconia off of Greece, you have a massive anchorage there that's being done. You have one off the coast of Spain out in the open Atlantic where it's being done. You have one in the South China Sea off the coast of Malaysia. The problem you have is there's no oversight, no regulation toward it. So you'll get ships coming alongside each other. There's no tugboats in place, so you're bringing very large vessels up against each other. You're rigging hoses between them. There's no containment booms if there's spillage of any kind. It's an environmental disaster waiting to happen. It's only a matter of time. It's not like it's going to happen. It will happen. But in the question, it becomes, will it be a disaster for which country? You know, Greece tried to push this off its coast by hosting military exercises in the Gulf, but they kept it up for quite a while. And like, I don't think they were doing any exercise except for running a ship through every now and then because they tried to push it off. But ship-to-ship transfers will happen because, well, one of the reasons you're seeing the ship-to-ship transfers is this too, is because of the sanctions on oil and fuel coming out of Russia. A lot of Russian oil was going to Europe. And so, you know, you could load a tanker that can go through the Turkish Straits of the Baltic and then offload in Europe. And so you know, that tanker was fine. Now you want to take that load of oil and go to India or go to China. Well, I don't want to transport it on a smaller ship. It's more efficient for me to put it on a bigger ship. So I'm going to take three vessels and load it into one big vessel and sail it that way. And so that's where the ship-to-ship transfers come in. And the problem is when it happens in outside of territorial waters, out beyond the 6 or 12 mile limit, depending on what UNCLOS sets as your territorial limit, there's really no oversight. There's nothing much we can do about it as long as it's taking place legally and there's no environmental issue. You literally have to wait for the accident to happen before you can react.
Well, I can think of this as the high seas are a lawless place, and we have Blackbeard running around doing stuff.
Ian Urbina, you know, made a name for himself writing about the outlaw sea, and in many ways,
episode 10. Why should we care about the outlaw ocean? Thank you very much.
There you go. And you know, it is. I mean, in many ways, it is. It's the Wild Wild West. It always is. The minute you get outside the 12 mile limit, you know, it is that Wild Wild West. And again, that's what you want the IMO to be sitting there doing. It's one of the reasons for UNCLOS, which again, the United States has failed to ratify. You know, again, one of the biggest countries that have never ratified it.
Right. And what I find somewhat surprising is we have a tiny commercial fleet now under US flag. So you would think we'd want to have more rules, since otherwise we're at the mercy of other nations for the shipping, no?
We do, and you're right. I mean, we've got the 21st largest merchant marine in the world. We haul about 2% of our import exports on U.S. flag vessels. We build 0.2% of the world ships. Compare that to China. China is one of the largest owners of ships. They own about one out of every five ships on the planet right now. They have one of the largest shipping lines in the world, Costco. At COSCO, the Chinese Overseas Shipping Company, not the big box store. And then, you know, they build more ships than anybody else, 61% this year in terms of construction. And you're right. You know, one of the things that the U.S. should advocate for is, you know, more control. The problem was, since the 1980s, we have really been deregulating and stepping back more than anything else. I would argue that since World War II, we have lost what I would argue is what is sea power. You know, ask most Americans what sea power is. They're going to tell you it's a big Navy. Well, we got a big Navy. We got aircraft carriers. We got submarines. We're great. We got it covered. What Alfred Thayer Mahan would tell you, the captain who wrote, you know, The Influence of Sea Power upon History, is that, well, yeah, Navy is good, but you also need trade. And trade's the other key aspect. And we kind of assumed trade would be handled by these big open registries. We didn't need to do it because our allies and these open registries would handle trade for us. So what do? We deregulated the industry. We removed a lot of checks on it. We removed the provisions to provide subsidies to build ships in the United States in the 1980s. You know, everyone likes to blame the Jones Act for the decline of the U.S. Merchant Marine. Jones Act has nothing to do with the decline of the Merchant Marine.
You want to explain what the Jones Act is just for everyone?
Oh, the Jones Act was the Merchant Marine Act of 1920, and specifically what they tend to talk about with the Jones Act is Section 27, which deals with something called cabotage, which is to move goods from one U.S. port to another U.S. port. You have to do it on a U.S.-owned, U.S.-built, U.S.-flagged, U.S.-crewed vessel. And in truth, what killed the U.S. Merchant Marine was the 1980s, when we ended the subsidies for building and operating ships in the international fleet, you know, ships that were trading outside the United States. We assumed that we could build those ships overseas. We assumed that the shipyards would take the slack up by building Navy ships, because we were going to build a 600-ship Navy. Instead, we've built less than a 300-ship Navy. And what we have found out is that all those U.S. shipping companies realize, well, I don't have to be a U.S. company. I can go overseas. And so the biggest shipping lines in the United States, U.S. Lines, Sealand, APL, all went overseas and got bought up by foreign companies. And that's why we find ourselves in the situation we are today. You look at Japan, Korea, and China, for example. They are the three largest shipbuilders in the world. They have robust navies, but they also have robust merchant marines. And they understand that a commercial shipbuilding industry is very important for sustaining their navy and their maritime dominance.
Can you help me with a couple of terms here? Because they you know, on one hand, you have commercial shipping, and then also you have a merchant marine. Is there a distinction there? You are a former merchant mariner. What is the merchant marine in a U.S. sense, and how is that different than, say, other commercial shipping?
Sure. I mean, so merchant marine is not an organization, so there's no such thing as the U.S. merchant marine. You'll hear the title used a lot. We even have a U.S. merchant marine academy. But in truth, what the merchant marine is the commercial sector, is the sector of ships that are crewed and licensed by people who are credentialed by the U.S. Coast Guard with a merchant marine credential. So, technically, if you want to be, understand the merchant marine, it's tankers going from Valdez, Alaska down to Long Beach. It is ships of Maersk Lines that are operated by their subsidiary in the United States, Maersk Lines Limited, that are U.S. flagged. It's the Staten Island Ferry. It's tugboats. It's boats on the Great Lakes flying a U.S. flag. It's barges going up and down the Mississippi. So, a commercial sector is basically, it's kind of like the airline of a country. It's like the airline pilots. It's under the FAA, but in this time it's under the Maritime Administration. So we as the U.S. have a very small merchant marine, 21, like just that 21st in the world in terms of its size, whereas China is number three, I believe, in terms of its size. Panama and Liberia are number one because of the registry, the open registry. But we do have a service academy that's geared to the industry, the merchant marine. It's the only industry that has one up at Kings Point, New York. We have state maritime schools, six of them scattered around the United States, Maine, Massachusetts, New York, Michigan, Texas, and California. So you've got, schools that are pumping out merchant mariners, but in the industry. We've got a very robust maritime industry. We still do a lot of trade coastwise. In the United States, you look at the tug and barge service on the Mississippi, you look at the coastal trade, you look at our ports. We've got some of the biggest ports in the world, LA and Long Beach and New York rank usually in the top 25 ports around the world. And we recently saw what happens when union workers in the Gulf and East Coast ports went on strike, how important trade is. And like I said, we've had a lot of examples here recently to highlight how important trade is, whether it was the supply chain crisis with COVID, Ever Given going sideways in the Suez, Dolly taking out the bridge in Baltimore, just a lot of examples of it.
So where do we go from here? We have a stable merchant marine vessels because of the cabotage and inland waterways. We're losing on the international trade front big time. China is building an ever larger fleet and controlling more and more of international trade. All the arrows are pointing the wrong way. And meanwhile, we have this enormous gray fleet out there that's busting all our sanctions and causing us more grief. So if I made you king of the seas, what would you do?
Well, before I answer that, James, there's another problem that we have too, and this goes right to Indo-Pacific area. Is that if we have a conflict, a peer-to-peer conflict against a country like China, we're in serious trouble. So number one, our U.S. Navy, one out of every five ships in the U.S. Navy are crewed by merchant mariners. The auxiliary vessels, the oilers, the supply ships, all of them have merchant marine crews on board. They're government service, what they call CIVMARs, civilian merchant mariners. So one out of five. We are critically short of merchant mariners in that field right now. We're about 1,400 mariners short. Matter of fact, the commander of Military Sealift Command a few months ago announced a program to lay up 17 ships so that he could repurpose those crews to crew vessels that are forward deployed. We just had one of those forward deployed vessels, the USNS Bighorn, an oiler, run aground off the coast of Oman because the ship was being used so extensively. I would argue the crew was severely fatigued that they had a navigation error. They ran aground. And for a brief period of time there, you had a U.S. carrier strike group, the Lincoln, without an oiler. There was no way to refuel it. Now, you don't need fuel for a nuclear aircraft carrier, but the escorts and the aircraft need it. And so we found ourselves at a loss out there. Should we have a conflict in Indo-PACOM and you need to deploy forces from the United States, the first leg of that is going to be a pool of reserve ships we have in the United States, what's called the Ready Reserve Force. These are roughly about 50 vessels. The average age of the vessels in the Ready Reserve Force are 44 years old, 44, and they don't have sufficient crew on board to be manned. So we got to call up additional mariners to crew those vessels. And we are critically short of mariners across the whole U.S. Merchant Marine, about 1,600. So the ships that we need to load up equipment for the Army, the Navy, the Marine Corps, the Air Force, we're going to have to find crews for them. We're going to have to hope the ships start because, again, they're 44 years old. We did a test of them back in 2019. They're supposed to be at an 85% readiness. In other words, 85% of the ships are supposed to be ready to go within 5 days. When we did the test in 2019, it was 40%. So, you know, if I'm Admiral Paparo, I'm counting on X amount of square, you know, 10,000 square foot of cargo coming my way. If I'm supposed to get that and now I only get 40% of that, what does that do? So I would argue we have severe problems when it comes to this area. Fixing it is we need to start now. A lot of people will tell you it's too late. We're too far gone. I don't buy that for a second. The best time to fix this was 40 years ago. The second best time to fix it is right now, because now is the time you need to invest in it. And we're seeing that starting to happen. You have Senator Kelly, along with Representative Waltz, putting out the Ships for America Act. So bipartisan support. Here you have a senator, Democrat from Arizona. Here you have a Republican congressman from Florida, now national security advisor, putting this out. One of the most interesting things about maritime reform is it is extremely bipartisan. It is crazy how bipartisan it is. We had a piece of legislation in 2022 called the Ocean Shipping Reform Act come out. Representative Garamendi from California, Democrat, Congressman Dusty Johnson, Republican from South Dakota. So this has broad bipartisan support. And what this new bill, 340-something page bill, is trying to do is trying to jumpstart shipbuilding, trying to get shipbuilding going again, trying to get tax incentives to start ship construction, trying to raise the level of maritime concern with basically appointing a maritime czar and a maritime board to review this elements. I mean, it's very much, you know, a lot of things when you hear Admiral Paparo talk all the time, he talks about this. It's always maybe not the first issue he talks about, but it's always the thing that's underlying the issue here is this commercial aspect. And it has secondary effects on the U.S. Navy. Why is it so expensive to build ships in the U.S.? Why is it so hard to repair ships in the U.S.? Because we don't have a commercial infrastructure. You know, China, if you look at where they build their aircraft carriers in China, right next to them, they're building tankers and container ships. They have the building and repair facilities right there. We don't. And that's largely because in the 80s, we turned our back on the commercial shipping sector and we decided to focus on Navy shipbuilding. And unfortunately, what that has done is turned our commercial shipyards into Navy shipyards. All they do is Navy contracts. They're sole source customers. And if you just have one customer, you're not going to make that customer angry.
So it sounds like there is violent agreement that we need to do this. So, I mean, are we going to do this, or are there bumps in the road? Are there saboteurs out there? Are there adversaries to this policy who are going to stand in the way and stop it from happening?
Well, right now it looks like it's going ahead. Like I said, it sounds like this is going to be one of the very first pieces of legislation that the Trump administration wants to get across the finish line. Obviously, with Representative Waltz, and I should mention Senator Rubio is also another co-author of the bill. You know, they're in the administration now, and so they have support. Senator Kelly is out full force talking about this. He's the only member of Congress or Senate, I should say, who's a graduate of the Merchant Marine Academy. So, you know, he's behind this. So I think there's a lot of support for it right now. There is opposition. There's always going to be opposition. There are groups who make the argument that the U.S. should not get involved in anything that deals with subsidies and with government kind of intervention in this areas. You have people who oppose the Jones Act. I mean, this is Cato will come out and always talk about the fact that the Jones Act is a problem and that we should open up the U.S. coastal trade to foreign shipping. I disagree with that for a variety of reasons. First off, they tend to misinterpret what the Jones Act is about, and so they use some kind of false information at times. But really the big thing is the panacea they think it'll create. They think if you repeal this one piece of legislation, it will fix all the woes that have been happening. I always use the phrase, it's going to be, you know, rainbows and unicorns. And I would argue it's not. What we need is reform. We need reform. We have neglected it. What you're seeing right now, the Ships for America Act is really the first substantial piece of maritime reform dealing with commercial shipping since 1970. So again, you know, we're talking 55 years. We've basically ignored this. And I think it has a lot to do with the fact that we take shipping for granted. We just kind of assume it was always going to be there. We take logistics for granted all the time. We always assume that it's going to be there. But in truth, it isn't. It was the dismantling in Congress of the Merchant Marine Committee, which was really one of the bedrock committees, I would argue, in the Congress, where you could go and actually argue these things and have a lot of smart conversations about it. And in truth, it sometimes gets taken over by the military. The military is always leery about talking about this because they get worried about getting saddled with the bill. You know, the Navy doesn't want to talk about it because, well, then we're going to have to pay for it. The Army talks about it all the time, but the Army doesn't want to say too much about it because they needed to move their Army brigades. The Army does you no good sitting in Fort Lewis, Washington. It's got to get overseas. But they don't want to say it because they don't want to be saddled with the bill. And so this has really got to be on a national level. And what we see in the Trump administration right now, more than I would argue in the Biden administration, is an attention on shipping matters. So it's a very conscious group coming into the Trump administration. I'm not saying positive or negative about the administration. I'm just saying how this administration views the subject.
I mean, it's a big list of things that need to be done. Wouldn't it be cheaper to have the South Koreans and Japanese build the ships than we do the other aspects?
Well, that's an argument too. I mean, there's no reason that, for example, in the international trade, you can't build ships overseas. That's actually fine. You don't have to be U.S. built to do that. So I think that is an element that needs to be looked at. I think in the short term, I think having South Korea, Japan build ships for us is great. And let's be clear, South Korea and Japan want to do that a lot because they are losing to the Chinese right now. This is the other subset that's going on. There's a shipbuilding war going out in East Asia. Draw a 1,000-mile circle around Okinawa, and 95% of all the world shipping is done in that circle. And it's almost all in Japan, China, and Korea. And Japan has been losing wholesale to China, and Korea is very concerned about the Chinese growth. And so they would love to be building commercial vessels for the U.S. Building naval vessels is a tough one because there's U.S. law that prevents that. Also because Japan and Korea, which do build Navy vessels, don't build them very fast, and they don't build a lot of them. So it's not like you're going to get a lot of solution from them. I argued recently, I did a Twitter thread and a Blue Sky thread on this where I talked about this. We actually have a lot of shipbuilding capacity in the United States. One of the problems we have is that we've been inconsistent in contracts on shipbuilding. So, for example, we were building Arleigh Burke destroyers up at Bath Ironworks in Pascagoula forever. I mean, we were pumping out two a year at each of those yards. But then what did we do? Well, we're going to build Zumwalt's up at Bath. So we destroyed the line to build the Burks up at Bath, and we're going to build 32 Zumwalt's. Well, we don't build 32 Zumwalt's. We build three. And then we tell Bath Iron, hey, start building Burks again. Well, you can't just start it back up. It's not like throwing a switch. You got to get all that material you had to build the Burks rebuilt back again. And now, you know, Bath is having a hard time building one Burke class a year. Same thing. We were building six submarines a year during the Cold War. Then we went down in the early, you know, late 1990s, early 2000s to building one a year. Now we're trying to get up to three. That's a big, you know, it's a 300% uptick all of a sudden. And so, you know, we need to get consistent. And one of the arguments I have about why we need to put commercial shipbuilding in the U.S. is because of the fluctuation of government contracts. What that allows you to do with commercial contracts forming the base of your shipyards, you can keep your welders, you can keep your ship fitters, you can keep the pipe manufacturers, the steel manufacturers employed, and you don't have to worry about kind of upticking, you know, all of a sudden you got to retrain and then the contract's over and you fire everybody and they go move to some other industry. And that's the real big problem we're seeing, especially in shipbuilding right now. Vendors who manufacture valves and key components, they're going away. We really need, much like what we did with the CHIPS Act, to bring chip manufacturing in. This is what the CHIPS Act is trying to do with ships. Let's try to get that infrastructure back in here so it's not costing us $2 billion to build a frigate.
Well, Dr. Sal, I think we are coming up to on our hour, but I do want to give you a chance to talk about your YouTube channel. We have a special affinity for it because, like our podcast, it is a question: what's going on with shipping? Why should we care about the Indo-Pacific? How did it start, and how did you end up with such a big following?
So, I started it out of a fluke. Never intended to have a YouTube channel. I got called by the BBC when Ever Given went sideways in the Suez. I was a contributor for G Captain, an online news site, and the editor, John Conrad, got the call from BBC to go on to talk about the Ever Given going sideways in Suez, and he couldn't do it because it was his daughter's birthday. So I owe his daughter immensely. So I went on, did an interview with BBC World News, and afterwards, one of the producers came on, talked to me, and said, "You're really good. You talked not just about the ship, but you talked about the history. You talked about the context of the ship." He goes, "You were like three people we would have to interview to get that same information." He goes, "You were really good." I said, "Well, I appreciate that. I'm sure you say that to everyone." He goes, "No, we're the BBC. We don't say that to many people." And he said, "We're going to call you and we're going to have you on a bit." And I was like, for six days, I was nonstop on the news talking about it. No one was more happier for that ship to get out than I was at the end of 6 days. But I decided to, you know, get my buddy John, and we did a half hour talk on Ever Given, because, you know, you do a news interview, it's 5 minutes. So we did a half hour talking about Ever Given, and I posted it on my YouTube channel. I just posted some other things on my YouTube channel over time, some lectures and things like that. And I got 3,000 views. I was like, "Wow, that's fun. Let's do this." And so the channel actually started about what's going on with Suez. So we were following Ever Given, and then Ever Given got unstuck, but then it was arrested in the Great Bitter Lake, and it was held there for 100 days. So I was doing updates on Ever Given, and then I had somebody comment on one video, sat there and said, "Hey, Sal, there's other ships you can talk about." I was like, "Oh, that's a good idea." And so I started talking about the shipping crisis off of L.A. and Long Beach, and it has just taken off since then. You know, I was like, my son was my 10,000th subscriber. I thought that was going to be the epitome of it all. It was like, it was great. So he got to be my 10,000th subscriber. A little question about why he didn't subscribe earlier, but anyway, he came on. And then it is just, what I find really fascinating is it's grown, you know, over time. There are incidents that kind of all of a sudden create these big, huge upticks. So the biggest video I ever had was one I did the morning Dolly took out the bridge in Baltimore. I did a 6-minute video just about what we saw. You know, basically I just, you know, here's the 6-minute video of it hitting the bridge. Let me break it down. And that got picked up by CNN, Fox News, MSNBC. And it was like 3 million views, and it was crazy. And it was just, but the one that I'm most proud of, the very first video I ever had to go over 1 million, was a video I did where I just talked about why big container ships don't come to the United States. It was me sitting down like, "Oh, this is interesting to me. I'm just going to do this video." And it just took off. And it was, what I find is the comments I get in my videos are people who are in the business, in the industry, "Hey, thank you for, you know, promoting the shipping industry. We really appreciate it." Or, "Hey, you got this wrong," you know, and which just happens all the time. But then I get people from the middle of nowhere. It's like, "Listen, I live in Manitoba. You know, I'm about as far away from shipping as you can get, but I love it. It's like, I'm really fascinated by it." And, you know, being an educator, I've been teaching for 20 something years now. I take very complex subjects and I don't dumb them down, but I make them so that people can understand them. And I think there's not enough people who do that in industries and in areas in military and political and in a whole batch of things. I joke when I go to conferences with shipping people, it's like, you guys are great, but you cannot talk to anybody outside your industry because you're terrible. It's like the military with acronyms. It's like, stop. Nobody understands what you're saying. It's like, you have to explain these things. And so I do. And I'm very fortunate. I have a great audience that watches it. My comments are fantastic. I always get the snide comments and, you know, you don't know what you're talking about. But then I get people who have, listen, I sail here. Let me tell you about this. It's very cordial and I like it. I think it's a great learning environment. And I learn as much from a lot of my videos as people who watch my videos. And to me, that's what educators should aim for. You know, I always talk about the ideas. I'm not an indoctrinator. I'm an educator. I want to create the dialogue. And for me, that's what the channel is. It's been a great dialogue.
All right. Well, the channel is What's Going On with Shipping. The gentleman is Dr. Sal Mercogliano, and we do thank you for joining us today, sir, and we hope we'll have you back.
Gentlemen, thank you so much for having me. It was a pleasure.
All right, Jim. Well, I was happy to get him on. I recently have become more, you know, with my other work with Sea Light, I've become much more fascinated with these dark fleets and these flags of convenience because of all the ones that are operating off of, the coast of Taiwan. And I recently had a little symposium and invited Sal to participate in it just to sort of help unpack what are all these ships doing. And it's really fascinating. I mean, when you think about, you know, all the security problems in the world, we tend to focus in on navies and maybe China Coast Guard and maritime militia, but now we have all these commercial ships we have to worry about.
Well, you look at international trade, trillions and trillions of dollars worth of goods transversing the oceans. And each ship is its own corporation, you know, with its own insurance. So it's a bunch of little companies floating around. And how do you keep track of all that?
Yeah, and I think just looking at, I mean, again, just staring at this for a little while, you know, just to get your head around the fact that there is this entire registry, this new registry, where Mongolian flagships, and you know, he talked about this. If you know anything about your Asian geography, Mongolia does not have a navy, right? There is no coastline, and yet they are able to register all of these ships and make it very, very easy for ships to register with them, because that's a way for them to make money.
Well, they have camels, and they're ships of the desert.
All right. Well, since we're going off the rails, I want to go off the rails and tell me a story. Do you have a shipping story for me?
Yeah, this is quick. My brother in 1978, so this is a while ago, had a friend whose father was a minor ship owner. So he spent the summer on one of the ships as he said, an unable seaman. And it was a miserable little ship. And the destination was Leningrad, as it was then known. So they pull into port. And they're met by the local party leaders, who are liaisons to all the mariners, hoping to either convince them to join the party or something. So they come on board, and they take my brother and his friend to the local party headquarters, which was staffed by buxom women serving lots of beer and handing out little books about Lenin. The end of the story is my brother did not become a Marxist, but he got very drunk.
Well, my story was a little less racy, I guess, when it comes to there was no beer nor buxom women involved. I was the air attaché in Hanoi. We had a voyage repair, which means that one of our merchant mariners came into Cam Ranh Bay to do minor repairs, you know, and they have, you know, contracts with various companies to do this. So one of them is essentially with Vietnam. And so my job on this one occasion, because the naval attache was otherwise occupied, I, as the Air Force guy, had to go down and basically get on this little launch and go out to this US Naval Service ship, Merchant Mariner, and climb the Jacob's Ladder. And, you know, so it's going to come up alongside, and this is a rope ladder, and I have to somehow figure out how to scale this thing, which, I mean, is not that hard, but you just know as the Air Force guy that you're going to fall in the water, right? And you can't, and certainly if that were to happen and the Navy attache were to have found out about it. So I was terrified that I was somehow going to miss the ropes and fall in the water. And thankfully, that didn't happen. I managed to get off that thing, on and off that thing, without getting wet. But so I have been on a USNS ship. My only function was to sort of say hello to everybody and be the official U.S. Embassy presence. But I managed to survive the Jacob's Ladder.
Well, it's your cat-like agility and cat-like fear of water that I think got you through.
Yeah. All right. Well, Jim, we do want to remind our audience that our podcast is sponsored by Bauer Group Asia, a strategic advisory firm that specializes in the Indo-Pacific. They apply unmatched expertise and experience to help clients navigate the world's most complex and dynamic markets. My co-host, Jim Caruso, is a senior advisor with Bauer Group, and you can find them at bauergroupasia.com. And we want to remind you that if you are listening to us as an audio podcast, that you can find us also on YouTube. We are at youtube.com/IP Podcast. Regardless of how you listen to us or watch us, we want you to make sure you hit that subscribe button so that we can get up to where Sal is with 400,000 subscribers. Right now, we're hovering just above 20,000, I believe. But we're coming for you, Sal. One of the things you can also do is you can go back and listen to some of the other podcasts. I really do recommend episode 10. We talked about that. That was Why Should We Care About the Outlaw Ocean with Ian Urbina, a fascinating podcast that I don't think has gotten nearly as much attention as it should, because it was really interesting. Certainly, you should find us out on your social media. We have a presence on X. We are on LinkedIn. And you can just look at us by just under our name at Indopac Podcast is on X. And of course, YouTube, just type in our name. Finally, you can email us IndopacificPodcast@gmail.com. That's IndopacificPodcast@gmail.com. We do read all of those. And we want to thank our producer, Ian. Follow him at Ian Ellis Jones on X. And that's it for this time. Please join us next time on Why Should We Care About the Indo-Pacific?